Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist of Freedom Estate. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African-American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
Welcome to the Gist of Freedom. I'm your host. My name is Preston Washington. I'm headquartered in Kansas City, Missouri. I'm a genealogist and historian. I'm the president of the Midwest Afro-American Genealogical Interest Coalition here in Kansas City. And if you're ever in the area, you can drop by our meetings the first Saturday of each month at the Bruce R. Watkins Cultural Heritage Center, 3700 Blue Parkway. Our guest tonight is Florence Tate. Florence is a civil rights activist in Ohio, member of CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. Also was a member of the Dayton Alliance of Racial Equality. She was a fundraiser for SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. She was the first African-American female hired on by the Dayton Daily News as a journalist, and in that position became subject to FBI investigations. Are you there, Florence? Okay, we're having a little typical difficulty. Stay on the line and don't hang up. We'll get it straightened out here in a minute.
Okay.
Are you there, Florence?
I'm here.
Oh, how are you?
Fine.
Welcome
how are
to
you?
The show. I'm great.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
I had a little difficulty getting to you. I called the wrong number, evidently. But anyway,
okay.
I'm here now.
Great. So, tell us a little about your early work there in is it Dayton, Ohio? Your civil
in
rights
Dayton,
work.
In Dayton, Ohio. Yes.
And how did you get started? What got your interest going on up there?
Well, I'd have to give you a little bit about my personal background so that you can understand where my interest came from.
Excellent place to start.
Okay. Early on, I was born in rural Tennessee in a little place called Eads, Tennessee, and I lived there until I was 8 years old when my mother moved to Memphis, Tennessee, and there I moved to Memphis, Tennessee, where I grew up and finished high school and went to Lemoyne College, which is now Lemoyne Owens College in Memphis. And later years, I graduated with a degree in media communications from Antioch College in the Baltimore campus. And I suppose my first experience in being black as opposed to the majority population was when I was a little girl, about 3 years old, and I remember sitting around the fireplace with my father and other members of the family, and my father was reading from a black newspaper, which I think was either the Chicago Defender or the Pittsburgh Courier, whichever one had a pink color, and he was reading about the lynching of a cousin of ours, a young man who was 19 years old who had maybe the month or two before then, and was just making the paper, had been lynched in a nearby town. So from that experience, I was aware that something could happen to black people that they couldn't do anything about. And that was just in my consciousness from a little girl. And the way I got involved in the civil rights movement was I had grown up married and so forth, and we were living in Dayton, Ohio. I had a little son, and I couldn't be active in the civil rights movement with him as a baby, but as soon as he got older, I joined Dayton Corps, which had been in existence for a little while, and I had been reading about them, and they were called outside agitators and all that. And they had demonstrations and sit-ins and so forth, and I wanted very much to be a part of that. And as soon as it was possible for me to join them, I did. And that was the beginning. That was in, I suppose, 1960-1961. And from belonging to CORE, where we did the usual kinds of things that were going on at the time, protests, demonstrations, sit-ins, voter registration, that kind of thing. And from that was the beginning of my involvement. And one of the things that galvanized me was in, I believe, in 1957, when I was living in Dayton, but it was when the Little Rock, the time the Little Rock kids integrated the Little Rock High School, and there was the National Guard had to be called out and so forth. And I watched these little kids going through the line of white people who were yelling and cursing and throwing things at them, and I was just amazed at their bravery, that they could walk through that hostile line. And I said to myself, now, if those kids in the South, and I knew the South from having lived there, if those kids in the South can do that, then surely where I am in Dayton, Ohio, where I don't have that, I'm not facing that kind of hostility, I can do something. So as soon as I could, I joined Dayton Corps. And later, a couple of years later, it developed into the Dayton Alliance for Racial Equality, which was an offshoot of CORE, and we continued to do the same kinds of things. So that was my introduction to the civil rights movement.
How did you meet Stokely Carmichael?
I met Stokely after we had formed DARE. It had been CORE, and then we formed DARE, which was the Dayton Alliance for Racial Equality, and we were doing the kinds of things that that you know about or read about: voter registration, demonstrations, sit-ins, that all of those things. And after Stokely issued his cry for Black Power, then the whole country was aware of this new movement called Black Power. And soon after he was elected as chairman of SNCC, he was on a speaking tour and a fundraising tour in Southern Ohio, and he was going to speak at this Unitarian church, of which there were few Black members. And we had attended, my husband and I had attended the church from time to time. So when Stokely and his friend, who was a field secretary, Ivanhoe Donaldson, came to Dayton to that church, the pastor, who knew us from reading about us in the paper, or maybe we had come across him at some civic activity, I can't remember how, but anyway, he called and asked us if we would host Stokely Carmichael and Ivanhoe Donaldson, who had expressed interest in staying with a Black family when they came to Dayton. So I'm sure we were one of the few Black families that the pastor knew. And we went to church that Sunday and listened to Stokely's speech, which, by the way, was just spellbinding and very unexpected, because they expected him to talk about Black Power, and he talked about transcendentalism. And the people were kind of awestruck, because that's not what they were expecting. But in any case, that's how we met, and he went home with us, or they went home with us, and it was supposed to be overnight. But he talked and was getting us all interested and excited about the Black Power movement, because we had the Dayton Alliance for Racial Equality was a nonviolent organization, and we had not thought of any kind of militancy beyond what we were doing. But listening to Stokely and Ivanhoe talking about Black freedom, Black liberation, Black power, and we were converted to SNCC's philosophy of Black Power. And
could you, excuse me, Florence, could you explain transcendental?
Transcendentalism.
For the lay folk out there.
It's, well, I don't know how well I can explain it, but it was a philosophical movement that started in New England, and you know, it involved some kind of philosophical thing that I don't even remember what it was, but I know that his speech was about transcendentalism, which was something that the Unitarian Church was had espoused. And so he spoke to them in their own language instead of speaking to them about Black Power. I'm sorry, but I can't give you.
Oh, that's okay. Do you remember Do you remember any specific quotes from that speech that made you want to join that particular movement?
No, I knew about the movement before the speech. I knew about Stokely and SNCC and Black Power. I knew about it. But there was nothing in his speech that was directly about Black Power that influenced me to join that movement. It was later, after we went home, and we talked for 3 days, you know, at my house about various kinds of things. And we were drawn to, it made good sense to me that Black people should band together to try to do things for themselves and be in charge of their own lives and amass some kind of political power and economic power in the country. And it just was a very appealing philosophy. But there was nothing that he said at church that had already taken place that my interest in the movement.
Did he convert anyone that you thought he would never convert?
No, it was, well, no, because the group of us, I invited people over from the Dayton Alliance for Racial Equality that we had been working with all the time, and everybody was pretty much primed to move on to the next step because we had pretty much decided that the work that we had done towards integration was not going to accomplish the freedom of Black people in the country, and we were kind of primed to move on to the next step. So there were maybe six or eight people who came, and we took it back to our core meeting, our DARE meetings, and just gradually people started, we started participating in the Black Power movement. We formed a group. I co-founded a group called the Black Emojis, which was a group of women who were from DARE, and then some other women who were kind of social activists in other areas and social friends of ours joined with us, and we formed the Dayton Afro-American Cultural Center and had all kinds of programs and lessons and teaching classes and so forth. And
was there any kind of racial incident or a major incident that made you want to move on?
No, there was no. There were incidents all the time. There was an incident, but it wasn't what motivated us. It was there was a riot during that summer. I think it was either 67. I think it was 67 when there were riots all over the country in Detroit and Newark and different places. And the same.
Were there any riots there in Dayton?
In Dayton, yeah, we had a 3-day riot in Dayton. But by that time, I was working at the Dayton Daily News, and I covered the riot as a journalist. So, and in those days, you could it's kind of complicated, but I could be an activist, a civil rights activist, and also a journalist. And that was because it was at the time when we had opened up various kinds of positions that had not been open to Black people, and there was kind of a these corporations and organizations were vying with each other to get what they call qualified Black people to work. and there were no black people at this at the Dayton Daily News, and they were interested in hiring a journalist, and they hired a black man, and he was there maybe 6 months, and then they hired me. So it was in those terms, in that time, I was a prized kind of employee because I was the one that they found to be the first woman to integrate the staff of the Dayton Daily News. So the fact that I was active in civil rights was not, did not hamper my work as a journalist. So I was both a part of the movement and working as a journalist at the same time that the riots occurred, and that the riot, 3-day riot occurred. And I went and covered that with the photographer in the street doing, witnessing what was going on and so forth. And they couldn't send any white journalists into the area because, it was a black-white thing, and the white people would be afraid to come in there. So the newspaper was glad that they had me and could send me to cover the riots. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been covered.
How close did you have to get to the action to get the story?
Right in the middle of the action, in terms of the young people in the streets who were breaking in the stores and setting fires or whatever was going on that made it a riot. I interviewed some of them and to find out what their grievances were or what they had to say, and it was all a result of many things that had happened. It was happening all over the country and had happened in terms of police brutality and the inadequate housing and no jobs, and that the kind of thing that was ignited at that particular point in time. I don't know if it could have happened sooner or if it would have happened later, but at that point it was just kind of in the air all over the country that black people were rebelling.
Must have been a pretty trying experience. You weren't tempted to throw a bottle or two, were you?
Oh, absolutely not. I was at work. I had my pen. I had my pen and pad. And after it was over, then I went into the black community, interviewing various middle-class people to get their response or their reaction to what had gone on. And no, I was never tempted to participate in the riot. I was there to cover the riot, which I did.
Mm-hmm. Was your you said you had a photographer or a cameraman with you?
Right. And
on the assignment? Was that a person
yes.
of color?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
It had to be a person of color. Bernie Boston, and he went on to be a famed photographer at one of the major dailies. I can't remember if it was the Boston Globe or maybe it was the New York Times. But anyway, he became a prize-winning photographer. This was sometimes later, of course, after that. But he kind of got his chops at the Dayton Daily News.
What photos would he have taken that people might be familiar with? Any memorable photos?
I don't remember any particular photos, but photos of the action, the people in the streets, breaking in the businesses, and just a general kind of angry atmosphere. And I don't remember a specific photo, but there were numbers of photos that he took that portrayed what was going on. Mm-hmm.
You talked about interviewing suburbanites and urbanites. What were the differences, if any, in the reaction between the suburban folks and those in the urban core?
I didn't interview suburbanites because they would have been white people in the surrounding territory, and that's not what we did. I interviewed middle-class black people in adjacent neighborhoods to where the action was going on. And these were people who were teachers, engineers, government workers, and so forth, to see what their reaction had been. And theirs was one of understanding why people were so angry, but never would have thought of doing that themselves. So it wasn't that these people were denounced. It was just that they would not have participated because they weren't even participating in the civil rights movement, which was nonviolent by and large. When you hear now people saying that they were in the civil rights movement or they were part of the sit-in, if all of the people who claimed that they were there had been there, it would have been a different story. There were maybe from 15 to 20 people at any one time in the local civil rights movement.
Okay. So they were supporting the people in the hood, so to speak, and really were not actively opposed to what they were doing, but felt some sympathy for what they were.
Yes, felt
for what
some
was going
understanding,
on.
And it was not the kind of expression that they would have made. They would, you know, would maybe talk or meet or that kind of thing, but in terms of getting out there, putting their bodies on the line, either in the civil rights movement and certainly not in a riot, but it was, you know, just regular middle class people who were kind of not satisfied with the status quo, but who were not rebelling against it.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, or it came to my attention, that you became the subject of FBI investigations. What can you tell us about that?
It's only in retrospect that I know that I was being watched for a long time. And it wasn't that I was doing anything in particular that was out of the ordinary for civil rights movement activists. It's just that at that time, the FBI, that was their job, to spy on the civil rights movement, whether you were doing anything or not. And people would follow you and sit outside in the car, and you could hear, you wouldn't know that there was somebody on the line, but there would be a hollow feeling, and you would know that somebody else was on the line. And only in retrospect, or long after the fact, did I really have proof that this is what had happened. I mean, they would stand outside, sit outside in cars, in the alley behind the building where we would have our meetings, and if there were demonstrations, there were always police that you could see, but there were also FBI people among the group of the spectators, so to speak. And the way that I know it, again, was in retrospect, because you couldn't identify these people, but once I got my FBI file, then I could tell from the dates, and they knew where you were, who you met with, what time a person was at your house, and if you picked them up at the airport, just all of the details that you would know it happened because somebody had been watching you. And they had been watching our group from the time it was formed, or before I ever joined it. But once the Black Power movement was undertaken, then everything that I did, and I'm sure that a lot of other people did, was clocked. It was around the clock kind of watching and listening and spying and infiltrating. I could tell from my FBI files, a lot of it, well, most of it was redacted and blacked out, but you can tell enough by the dates and the things that they did have in there. You could pretty much surmise who was there and how they came to know what you were discussing and so forth. You know, there had been informers. And so I just got my FBI file sort of on a hummer.
How'd you learn about that file, Florence?
Well, we knew that there had been a program. This was after the fact. We knew that there had been a program called COINTELPRO where they were spying on the civil rights movement and black activists, period. So I figured that I had an FBI file because I had been very active during the time that the I know that, you know, the FBI was active in terms of watching people in the movement and so forth. So mm-hmm. at this time, I was working as the press secretary for the mayor of Washington, Mayor Marion Barry. You may have heard of him.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. But anyway, I was Marion's press secretary, and the Washington Post, which was the big newspaper in town, still is, wanted to get Marion's FBI files because he had been active in the civil rights movement and in other kinds of things that he had a name for being militant and so forth. So they was the Washington Post wanted to see what he had been doing or what he was accused of having done before he was ever elected mayor. So they asked me as his press secretary to ask him if they could petition the FBI for his files, because the only way you could only get your own files upon request. I mean, an individual citizen could, but the mm-hmm. newspaper could request could get permission from you to request your FBI files from the FBI, from the Justice Department. And so when they asked me to ask Marion if they could request his files, I just told them automatically, no, you can't request his files. But it put in my head, I think I'll send for my own files. So I filed, okay. You had to write the Justice Department, whatever you had to do, I can't remember now. And maybe a year later, I was no longer working for the city government, working as Marion's press secretary. I had come back home. And they, there was a knock on the door, and I went to the door, and there was this man with a big package that said Justice Department. I said, oh, my God, what are they accusing me of now? But it was the FBI files. It took that long for them to get it together to send to me. And it's a big Bible-sized stack of sheets of inquiries back and forth from various offices of the FBI, and with the recording of every meeting, every letter to the editor, every flyer that you had helped distribute, every your whole move, any meetings that you had had with other organizations or conferences or conventions, which were happening all over the country, because it was kind of a loose confederation of various civil rights movements, various civil rights organizations. So sometimes, from time to time, we would meet in certain places and just discuss what was going on or what we wanted to do next or what was happening. And there was always somebody there. We know now, in looking back at the notes that they kept, and one of the things that was particularly, I have my FBI files here with me, so I could refer to it from you. But one of the things we find out is that they had you classified depending on what they thought you were doing. I mean, you were either labeled an outside agitator or an agitator or someone who was seditious, and they would change your term, your terminology, a description of you based on what they thought you were doing at the time. And one of the when Stokely wanted to organize a group in Dayton, then I was named as the representative of SNCC in the Dayton area and worked with the young people on college campuses surrounding there. And Stokely would come into town with other civil rights people, would come into town for a rally or a meeting or fundraising or whatever he was there for. And they, the FBI, and I know this now from reading the file, they decided that they would try to prevent a SNCC chapter from being organized in Dayton, because they regarded SNCC as very radical and militant and revolutionary, however they termed it. And I have this note from J. Edgar Hoover himself to the regional office of the FBI, which was in Cincinnati. And this thing is called, it's headed from the FBI director's office, and it's called the Counterintelligence Program. Now, that's COINTELPRO, if you've heard of that.
Yes, I've heard of that.
Counterintelligence Program.
Yes.
And it says Black Nationalist Hate Groups, Racial Intelligence, and it was on, and in parentheses, Stokely Carmichael. And it says, reference is made to Cincinnati Airtel, caption Stokely Carmichael is miscellaneous sedition, and attached letter. The communication indicated that Stokely Carmichael visited Dayton to help unite the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, and a group headed by Charles Tate of Dayton. It was also noted that Florence Tate, the wife of Charles Tate, is a particular friend of Carmichael. You should analyze, this is what he's saying to the Cincinnati office.
Yeah.
He said, you should analyze this situation to determine if it might be possible to hamper this unification by causing trouble between Charles Tate and Carmichael. This might be done through an anonymous letter to Tate alleging that Carmichael was far too friendly with Tate's wife. Furnish the Bureau your observations concerning this matter and any recommendations for counterintelligence action. No counterintelligence action should be taken without Bureau authority. During the visit to Dayton, Ohio, Carmichael was made extremely inflammatory statements saying that the system of government in the United States must be destroyed and this must be accomplished by violence. Tate is apparently fully in sympathy and anxious to help Carmichael in the Dayton, Ohio area. Now, further on, when the they had not found an opportunity to do what they were directed to do, but this is some months later. This is a counterintelligence program answering from Cincinnati, answering J. Edgar Hoover's request. It says, concerning the Bureau letter of February 29, 1968, captioned as above, CI, RTEL, whatever that is, 2-12-68, captioned Stokely Carmichael, miscellaneous sedition and attached letter. Counterintelligence measures to hamper the formation of the Dayton, Ohio SNCC groups by causing distrust and discord between Charles and Florence Tate and Stokely Carmichael was under consideration, particularly in view of the fact it was reported that Florence Tate was a particular friend of Carmichael's. However, Carmichael's recent announcement of his pending marriage to Miriam Makeba, South African singing star, and his infrequent contacts with the Tates has all but eliminated this possibility. The Cincinnati office has, and this was blacked out, and any opportunity to direct this group will be utilized and capitalized upon if the situation arises. However, as instructed, no counterintelligence action will be taken without Bureau authority. That's just... There's so many examples of so many things that that showed that, you know, we were part of who they were spying on in the COINTELPRO program.
Yeah, I see.
Mm-hmm.
For some of our younger listeners out there, can you describe some incidents that SNCC was involved in or some of the specific inflammatory comments of Stokely?
Well, they considered it inflammatory. A remark, let's see if I can find a remark, but if Stokely said that the United States government was oppressing black people and we needed to organize to achieve our liberty, anything like that was considered an inflammatory inflammatory statement, and anything that would talk about becoming in an independent state or anything like that would be called seditious and would be labeled seditious. And any organization that if you were ever in the company of any organization in a conference or a convention, it could be people, individuals that you didn't even know, but they would hook you up to this particular organization to say that you were a part of it, whatever its program was, and they would include the description of all of these organizations and what they did, anything from the Nation of Islam to Black Panthers to Ram to anything that they could think of. They even have me hooked up to the organization that Malcolm formed when he came back from Africa, and I had no idea. I was in a meeting with apparently when somebody was there from that organization, but they have me hooked into that. And you can see they also tried to pit people against each other to destroy the organization or the possibility of your organizing the community and so forth. So they would tell one group that this other group was planning to do violence to them and had people suspicious of each other. That was the COINTELPRO program. That was what it was for, to break up any kind of unity or possibility of organization.
Did you have any particular experience with King or Malcolm or Vernon Johnson?
No.
Any of those individuals?
No. With Lyndon Johnson, did you say?
No, Vernon Johnson.
Vernon Jordan.
Vernon Jordan, I'm sorry,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I knew them. I know Vernon, and I knew him, but I did not have any, because he was in the organization, the Urban League, which was not a militant organization. It was not a part of what we were doing. But I knew him as I knew, you know, all of the leaders of the various organizations.
Oh, okay. What about Vernon Johns that was ran Montgomery Church before King?
No. That was in the South, and we were in the Midwest. So we were not doing anything in my particular group, the Dayton Alliance for Racial Equality. We just worked in Dayton and Cincinnati and on the college campuses, Wilberforce, Antioch, Central State University. So it was, and mind you, I for SNCC, I was a fundraiser, and I would arrange speaking engagements and help organize rallies and things like that. I was not a member as such of SNCC. I was 15 or 20 years older than these young people who were working down south with voter registration and trying to organize black people to become independent and to seek their liberation from the oppression that was happening in the South, the segregation and Jim Crow and all that. So those were young people, of whom Stokely and Rapp and all of them were a part of that. I was an older person in Ohio who simply supported them and was working with the local groups. You understand the difference?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Were you involved in any colleges there in Dayton on the college campus? Did you do any recruiting
was kind
or
of
fundraising amongst them?
The liaison between the college campuses and SNCC. I would visit the campuses and help the young people if they were organizing some kind of demonstration or protest or sit-in or whatever. I would help them in any way that I could in terms of helping with leaflets or writing papers or that kind of thing. And the three colleges that I worked with were Central State University, Wilberforce University, and Antioch College. And one of the an interesting thing, the young people on Central State's campus were particularly active and militant, and one of the young men who was a part of the student organization at that time has become a very famous civil rights lawyer now in New York, Michael Warren. I don't know if
Michael Warren, okay.
Yeah. If you,
where would
you
they
know.
Sit in there in Dayton? In the school,
if they wanted to change, see, the young people were responsible for there being black studies programs and departments of African American culture and history or Africana. There were no such organizations. There were no such departments in schools where you could study black history and literature and so forth. So now, all of the major universities have African centers, studies, or Afro-American cultural centers, that kind of thing, and teach black literature, black history, and all that. Well, it all emanated from those young students during the 60s who sat in at the president's office or the school superintendent's office demanding that there be black studies in the colleges. And so they were on campus, and they some of the surrounding businesses and so forth that did not hire blacks or did not blacks could not patronize the stores if it was a restaurant or something, then they broke all that up by their sit-ins and protests and so forth. So it was just around in that area, and I was liaison from SNCC to these young students at those universities.
I see. Have you written any books?
No, but I'm working on a book now, and it's called FBI's Most Wanted Press Secretary.
Okay. You guys had a lot to lose back in those days doing your work in the civil rights movement.
We had a lot to gain, too, because we were gaining what we call the freedom and liberation for the black people in the country. So we didn't feel it was any kind of sacrifice. It was something that needed to be done, and we felt the urge to do it and the necessity to do it, and we were ready to put our bodies on the line to accomplish our goals. So it didn't, I didn't think of it in terms of giving up anything, really.
Did the students on the campus face any repercussions or anyone?
Oh yeah, they would be expelled or thrown out of class and ostracized, and that just kind of what you would expect. Some of them were dismissed from school and had to couldn't come back there, had to go to another school if they could get in, and that kind of thing.
Okay.
So that were retribution against the students, you know. But
are you in touch with any of those individuals today? With
absolutely.
Any of them?
I'm in touch with Michael Warren. In fact, Mike is a family friend. I'm in touch with Michael. And
was Michael expelled?
Yes, he was.
He was? Okay.
He was expelled, but he got back in school, and there's a picture that I have and that he has that was in the local paper where I accompanied him back to the campus to demand that the administration readmit him, or the students
I was active.
So that's just a small part, actually, of what I've been involved in, the National Black Political Convention in Gary, the African Liberation Day demonstration in Washington, and the 6th Pan-African Congress in Tanzania, and a number of things. I was very active from 61, I would say, to 70, and by that time the movement had, the active, most active part of the movement had died down, and some of the things that we had done set the stage for the election of black mayors, black councilmen, black people on the Board of Education, none of which had happened before, but it grew out of the work that we had done to bring consciousness to black people and to organize into groups where you could protest against mistreatment or protest against segregation, discrimination, and so forth.
Florence, could you give us a description of some of those groups that you mentioned that you were involved in? It sounds very interesting.
Okay, let's see. I have my little
give us a little bit of a description of each one of those, if you
will. Okay, will do. Now, I was not a part of this group, but the group is described in here as being part that I was a part of. And I'll just read the Black
Panther. Is that from your FBI
file?
All
of this is from the FBI file. Every letter to the editor, every flyer, anything that you had ever done, any speech that you had made, was all recorded in here. I'll show you what I'll read what they said about SNCC, for example. A source advised, now this source is an informer, of course. A source advised the Student National Coordinating Committee, SNCC, formerly known as the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It's a non-membership organization founded in 1960 during the Civil Rights Movement in the South. Under the leadership of Stokely Carmichael, who served as the national chairman during the period 1966-67, SNCC evolved from a civil rights-oriented group into a full-blown black revolutionary organization. A publication entitled, quote, 1967 High Tide of Black Resistance, unquote, indicates the year 1967 was considered by SNCC as a historic milestone for the liberation of black people in the United States and the year that revolutionaries throughout the world began to understand more fully the impact of this black movement. The publication declared that, quote, liberation will come only when there is the final destruction of this mad octopus, the capitalistic system of the United States, with all its life-sucking tentacles of exploitation and racism that choke the people of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Now, they're quoting from a position paper of SNCC. The realities of black life, together with the recognition instilled in SNCC workers, forced its members to further popularize the legitimacy of self-defense and rebellions when oppression became too great. A second source advised that H. Reb Brown succeeded Carmichael as national chairman of SNCC in May 1968 and served in that capacity until June 1968, at which time SNCC reorganized, creating 10 deputy chairmen in an effort to relieve pressure by law enforcement. In April 1969, SNCC moves its national headquarters from Atlanta, Georgia, to New York City, where it is presently located. H. Reb Brown announced at a press conference in New York City on July 22, 1969, that he had been elected chairman of SNCC. He announced the organization was dropping the word nonviolent from its title and will be known as the Student National Coordinating Committee, with a revolutionary political council functioning as its governing body. Brown at that time stated the use of force is necessary in obtaining revolutionary goals. Now, that's their description of what SNCC
was. What were some of the other groups other than SNCC, particularly those that you were involved in? But what about those that you were involved in?
CORE and DARE. Let's see if I see anything about. Well, I see something about the Black Panther Party, and see, it's not all together. The African Liberation Day Coordinating Committee, let's see what some.
Sounds like they might have had some listening devices established inside your home and in some of the places that you were meeting.
Absolutely. They knew, and you can tell from what's redacted in the paper when the meeting was held, and you know who was there because it would be a small meeting, but within that group, and it plants suspicion later because you're trying to figure out now who in the group might have been the informer. But they will know the time and what your subject of your discussion was and who was there. And so, yeah, there were always
Did you see any distinction between black power and civil rights during that time?
Yeah, the black power movement was a movement that did not describe itself as nonviolent. It was a group that said you would meet violence with violence. You wouldn't go out and attack anybody, but you would protect yourself through militant means. You would meet force with force. And the CORE and the NAA and so forth were not militant groups. That they were nonviolent groups, were sworn to nonviolence and would accept any violence and sort of turn the other cheek and not fight back. Well, Black Power, the movement said they would fight back if attacked, and that that black people should organize themselves in their communities and so forth, so they could resist any kind of attack or any kind of racial oppression or whatever was undesirable, that you wouldn't just be on the receiving end of violence without fighting back.
And did they ever pass any laws there in Dayton about carrying guns, particularly after the Black Panther Party started carrying weapons out on patrol? Or did that kind of activity go on in Dayton? Did anybody there face any violence with violence?
Not that I'm aware of. Not that I'm aware of, no.
Mm-hmm.
We were never attacked as such in Dayton.
Did you have any knowledge of that occurring specifically in any other area that you...
Well, down south, there were always people being beaten and killed and jailed and so forth.
Did you have any relatives or special friends that with that?
All of the young people in the South who were working in the South, it was just a part of their existence that they had to be protected from the police, or the police would find them and beat them up or break up the meetings. And you know the case of Schwerner Goodman Cheney, that these young civil rights workers, and that's the best remembered, I guess, of the case. But then Medgar Evers and a lot of people whose names you would not know, were not famous, or didn't become famous, but were killed. And John Lewis, for example, was beaten to a pulp. And but they're just examples that you know. Many people.
Did anyone from your group there in Dayton ever go south to join in any of those demonstrations that you're aware of?
Any young people? Sometimes young people would go from Dayton to a meeting or something in Atlanta, but not to. I don't know anyone that went from Dayton to join SNCC the SNCC was formed by, you know, earlier than the student groups on campuses around there. So they were already a formed organization, and the young people who formed SNCC, many of them had come from northern schools and so forth to go and work on voter registration or voter education in the South. So all of those young people, for the most part, were from, you know, they left, some of them left Ivy League schools to go down South to be a part of the movement. But I didn't know anybody personally from Dayton, I don't think, because the people in our group, in CORE and DARE, these were adults. These were, you know, people working. Some of them were professional people, or some worked in the factory. But we were all adults. I mean, in late 20s,
yeah,
early 30s, that kind of thing.
These
were teenagers. Mm-hmm.
Our producer, Leslie Guest, spent last weekend in Florida and became familiar and learned about a couple by the name of Harry T. Moore and Harriet Moore. Are you familiar with this couple? And if so, do you know anything about their story that you could tell us?
No, I don't. I live in Florida, but I moved here 10 years ago. So that was in 2002, and things had long been over in terms of the active part of the civil rights movement. So I don't know them, and I don't know about them. There was another couple here in Florida somewhere, that were very prominent in the civil rights movement. I can't think of their names right now. I really can't.
Mm-hmm.
But no, this is we're talking about 50 years ago. So.
Oh, I see. Students there in Dayton, were they ever involved in any of the freedom riots that went into the South?
Yeah, one of the young people, a couple, Ruth and Tony Perot, were part of the Freedom Rides to South. I can't say exactly when, but Ruth was the chairman of Cleveland CORE. Her home was Dayton, but she was living in Cleveland at the time, and I know that they were involved in Freedom Rides, but nobody that I know of in Dayton, Mm-hmm.
Okay. And for the younger folk out there, could you explain what a freedom ride was?
They were the bus companies and the trains and all of the methods of transportation were segregated, and the young people who were in CORE or some of the other active organizations, their purpose was to go south to test the laws of discrimination and to fight against them, and they went in busloads to go to the south, and they were stopped at the various bus stops, and some of them were beaten and arrested and that kind of thing, but it was always in protest against discrimination, segregation.
Are you in touch with any of those freedom riders today, the two people that you mentioned?
No, I'm not in touch with them. I worked with Ruth in Washington, D.C. in the 80s, but I have not been in touch with them since then. And my husband worked with her husband in Washington, D.C. You see, this was such a long time ago, and so many things have happened, and people have scattered, spread, and gone on into different endeavors and so forth, and some people that you know. Now, I'm in touch with most of the people that I knew from SNCC. These are the young people that, well, they're all old people now, but young people that I have kept in touch with over the years. Courtland Cox and Ivanhoe Donaldson, and of course Marion was a part of SNCC. Marion Barry was a part of SNCC. Karen Edmonds, I mean, names that you would not know necessarily, but
okay.
People.
Well, here's
that
a name
have.
That here's a name that we all know, and that's Barack Obama. What do you think about the recent election and the voter suppression move put on? Any threats of going backwards, any similarities? How's that
yes,
impeded
I
the progress that we've made?
I think
talk a little bit about that.
I think the Tea Party and people of that political persuasion would really like to see things back to where they were before the Civil Rights Movement, before the Voting Rights Act. I say with small exaggeration that they really would like to see us back in slavery. They would take, when they say, I want my country back, they mean that they want it back like it was before black people had any amount of freedom in the country. And I think that I was very happy, of course, to see Obama reelected, and the voter suppression I regard as just about the same as poll tax. Before the Voting Rights Act, the black people in most places in the South could not vote, and for those who were brave enough to try to register to vote, you would have to pay a poll tax to vote, a poll tax, and you would have to be able to interpret the Constitution, and you would have to know the names of the capitals of all the states in the country. I mean, you were tested. You were tested, and very few people, poor people, didn't have the money. So it was a form of voter suppression then, and we say that the methods that they were using to prevent black people from voting, you know, the long lines, the change in the registration dates, or sending out notices that it was the voting was on the 8th when it was really on the 6th, and demanding different kinds of identification that had not been done before. And so we say that's equivalent to the poll tax. It's where they're trying to take things back to before the 60s. So, you know, I'm very, very pleased to see him reelected. But what I would like to see is for the national black community to come together in a way, I don't mean come together, but the various organizations get together and come up with a black agenda of things that we regard as major problems in the black community, like the high rate of unemployment. I mean, the disproportionately high rate of unemployment, the mass incarceration of young black men, the police killings we have, you know, you read about it in this place and that place and other place, but there's just been a series of police killings of young black men on the street who were supposed to be doing this, that, or the other. Oh, mm-hmm. They thought your wallet was
Lawrence,
a gun or something.
We're about mm-hmm. running out of time.
Okay.
It's been a pleasure having you on. It's been a very informative show. Do you have any contact information if someone wanted to contact you, if they had a question?
Yeah, they can contact. Well, I have an email address.
Okay. Would you mind giving us that?
It's H-U-A-M. That's H as in Harold, A as in avocado, U is unity, M Mabel, H-U-A-M at AOL.com. And I'm on Facebook.
And you're on Facebook.
I'm on Facebook. I'm the only 81-year-old woman I know on Facebook.
Well, I've got a 91-year-old mother on Facebook. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yes, okay.
I
congratulate
you
on that.
Well,
maybe we could become Facebook friends.
Yes. I want to congratulate you on being on Facebook.
Well, thank you. And give my regards to your mother. I'm happy to hear that I'm not the oldest person on Facebook. I always thought I was.
Okay. Any parting thoughts you would like for folks to know?
No, it's just that I have enjoyed talking with you, and I keep up with Leslie on Facebook, so she puts some wonderful information in history, and the way we got in touch, that I got in touch with Leslie, I had seen her name on something on Facebook, and she was talking about the Rosenwald schools in the South, the Little Red Schoolhouse in the South. She had done a lot of research and history and so forth, and I actually started school at one of those Little Red Schoolhouses. So I sent that to her, and she was very interested, you know. And from there, she looked up my background and whatever and thought that I would make a good guest for her show. So I'm
and
happy to be on.
And she was absolutely right and on target. We'll have to have you back on the show one day. I'm really interested in some of the, getting through some of that FBI file. I find that very, very interesting.
Well, stay in tune for, well, stay on the lookout for, I don't know when it's coming. I call it my forthcoming memoir, and I'm working on it. It's called FBI's Most Wanted Press Secretary. And I've been a press secretary professionally for a number of different politicians and so forth. So that's how we came up with the title. You
keep
know?
Us posted on that, and we'll also maybe want to talk about those Rosenwald schools when we have you back on.
Okay.
On a future date, and Leslie will be in touch with you.
All right. It was
okay.
So good talking with you.
Thank
okay.
you, Mrs. Tate.
Uh-huh.
I appreciate your visit tonight.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, there you have it, folks. We were online with Ms. Florence Tate, civil rights activist back in the 60s out of Dayton, Ohio. Friends with Stokely Carmichael, and shared with us her... some of her FBI file put together by the agents of Mr. Hoover. I'm your host. My name is Preston Washington. Our producer was Leslie Gist, historian and author. And we'll see you next time. Thank you and good night.